This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who you see at the grocery store, the gas station, maybe they're even your next door neighbors. But if you take the time to ask them about their past, you might just open up the door to some incredible stories. Those are the kind of journeys we take each time on this program, hoping to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories for posterity so their families know and we know what they did, and we don't forget the great price that has been paid for our freedom. Along the way, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, entertained, and oftentimes inspired by these stories from America's greatest generation. And if you've listened to the program for a while, you've heard me speak quite a bit about an organization called Honor Flight, committed to making it possible for World War II veterans to visit their memorial in Washington, D.C., free of charge. The Honor Flight Network now has nearly 150 different hubs around the country where local volunteers are raising money to make this happen. And more than 100,000 World War II veterans now have been able to make that journey. Wherever you're listening today, there is an Honor Flight hub in close proximity to you. So I hope that you'll encourage the veterans in your life to apply for this free trip of a lifetime. And I'd encourage you to get involved too, because it might just change your life. These flights are happening just about every day all over the country, but there's one that's about to take place that is quite unique because of the runway that this chartered jet is going to take off and land on. It's the historic runway at what was Castle Air Force Base in Atwater, California, a base that opened in 1941, just months before America entered World War II, trained pilots throughout World War II and well beyond. For decades, people growing up in the area got used to that sound of giant planes overhead, whether it was B-29s in the late 40s or B-52s and their giant refueling friends, the KC-135s in the 80s and 90s. The base was closed, though, during the Clinton administration in 1995. If you visit the area today, you'll still find a lot of that history. You'll find dozens of planes on display at Castle Air Museum, from the supersonic SR-71 Blackbird to the monstrous B-36 Peacemaker. A former Air Force One is there now, and many of the World War II planes that we hear about so much on this program, the B-17, B-24, B-25, B-29, you name it. Castle Air Museum keeps the great history of the base alive every day, but it's going to be celebrated and enriched in a really exciting way this Monday, October 27th, when more than 65 World War II veterans from an 8-county corridor of California take off from Castle's historic runway on a special mission to Washington, D.C. It's put together by Central Valley Honor Flight, and some of the veterans on the flight actually flew bombers and tankers off of that very runway during their time in the service. Of course, every veteran on the flight has a story to tell. So I thought, while I encourage anyone who is in Central California to be there at Castle for the send-off Monday morning around 7, and definitely to be there for the welcome home Wednesday night, October 29th at about 5:30, let's also get some perspective on who some of these men and women are who will be embarking on this very special mission. I did say women. There are four of them on board: Asian Americans, African Americans, Hispanic Americans, Native Americans, Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, every branch of service. It's quite a cross-section, and we're going to hear from a couple of those vets today. First, an unassuming man who was up close and personal with the top-secret project that helped bring World War II to a close. You know, before Hometown Heroes was airing on all the different stations it's on now, it started in 2007 on a single station, KMJ in Fresno, California. It still airs on KMJ. And one of the veterans I first interviewed that first year was a gentleman named Norris Jernigan. He's 89 now, and he will be on this honor flight from the former Castle Air Force Base. In fact, he was at Castle Air Museum last week for a gathering of the veterans going on this flight. That was pretty special. A local cattle rancher named Jim Cunningham and his team of volunteers donated and cooked up a great feast for the vets. And the veterans received guided tours of the historic planes and the other displays there. And I just happened to come across the tour group that Mr. Jernigan was a part of. Their guide had stopped in front of the B-29 and he was relating the story of the Enola Gay, the atomic bomb, and Colonel Paul Tibbetts. Mr. Jernigan was in that group, and he quietly said, "Paul Tibbetts was my commanding officer." The tour guide heard him, I think, but he continued on with his story. And I apologize for this later, but I interrupted and I said, "Did you hear what he just said?" The tour group was there looking at a B-29, kind of like the Enola Gay, but the guy standing next to him was actually part of the story. That was a pretty surreal moment. And they didn't have time to sit down and listen to Mr. Jernigan's entire story, but we're going to hear a good chunk of it here. And if you do make it out to Castle to welcome home these veterans on October 29th, maybe you can shake his hand. He grew up on a farm near Galt, California, and he remembers what it was like there after the news of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
We believed in the country, and we recognized that we had been attacked, and it was attractive to all the young men to get involved in the military. And as I saw a lot of my high school friends starting to disappear and going into the military, and then my older brother went into the military. And that, of course, was what eventually would happen to us if the war lingered on that long.
And it did, because the war was still going on as your 18th birthday approached in June of 1943.
Yes, I was sworn in the day before I was 18 so that I would not have to register for the draft. If I had waited one more day, I would have had to register for the draft, and I didn't want to do that. I wanted to select my own branch of service. I had originally wanted to be a pilot, so I enlisted in the Army Air Corps cadet program and went through partial training of that until they reached a point where all of the flight schools, bombardier schools, the navigator schools were filled to capacity at that particular time, and so they eliminated about two-thirds of our school squadron. So out of 240 guys in our school squadron, only about a third of them made it on to a higher level of training.
I know that had to be a crushing blow, as I've heard so many others describe over the years. They sent you to Amarillo, Texas for aircraft mechanics school. You were going to learn that, then aerial gunnery, but they closed that school. They sent you to Salt Lake City. You'd never heard of the 509th Composite Group, and all these left turns and right turns and spinning in circles had to be confusing. But in the end, God's plans are always better than ours. And, you know, it made you a part of some real historic developments.
We were sent to Fairmont, Nebraska to become a B-29 outfit. And it was a long time before they were able to get B-29s there for the crews, and they were training in B-17s. We were part of the 504th Bomb Group at that time, and our squadron was the 393rd Bomb Squadron. Finally, that first B-29 arrived, and we all dashed out to get a close-up of it, and it was immediately surrounded by MPs guarding it and with their guns drawn, and because it was still a pretty secret thing, and the B-29 was early on in its history.
Did you ever look at it and say, "I'm not sure that's really going to fly"?
Not really, because I saw it come in, and I thought, that's the most beautiful thing in the world.
But it would be carrying the most devastating thing in the world before long. What did you know, if anything, at this point, about the atomic bomb?
Well, we knew it was a top secret weapon. It was a bomb that had never been used before, and so we were just referred to it as the gimmick all the time. We didn't refer to it as an atomic bomb. In fact, I never heard the phrase atomic bomb until after the bomb was dropped, because we just didn't talk about it. I'm sure some of the intelligence officers that I worked for knew the full title of the thing, but I did not until the day that it was dropped. Let's back up just a little bit. As I said before, I was in the 393rd Bomb Squadron and part of the 504th Bomb Group at Fairmont, Nebraska. Unbeknownst to us, Colonel Paul Tibbetts was given an assignment to develop a military unit, train them, and be prepared to deliver this bomb when it was fully developed. He toured around different bases looking at bomb squadrons that were well advanced in their training, and our 393rd Bomb Squadron, of which I was part of, was his selection. All of a sudden, orders came through that our whole squadron was being pulled out of the 504th Bomb Group and sent to Wendover, Utah. Well, we'd never heard of Wendover, Utah either until we got there, out there on the edge of the salt flats. It's right on the Utah-Nevada border, stretched out there on the salt flats, a desolate place. Mm. And that was the site he selected to develop this this 509th Composite Group and train them there for security purposes. When we arrived at Wendover, they called an assembly of us, and we all gathered around the orderly room. And this lieutenant colonel that we had never seen before stepped up on the back of a weapons carrier truck and addressed the group. He said, "Gentlemen, I'm Colonel Paul Tibbetts. You're here because I've brought you here. You're here for a purpose." He said, "You've been selected for a top secret project, and we'll be in intense training for some time here. Everything is going to be secrecy. Security is high priority. You're not to talk about what you're doing here. You're not even to tell anybody that you are here. You're not to discuss your unit at all. If you do, there'll be consequences." Now, everybody is released to go on a two-week furlough. Well, that was good news.
That sounds like pressure, though, to me. Well, if you're a 19-year-old kid, they just tell you you're working on something top secret, now you're supposed to go for 2 weeks and not talk about it?
Yeah, how can you not talk about it? Well, some did talk about it, and all of a sudden they had orders arrive saying return to your base immediately, and were met with discipline. There was one example that I've heard about it. I guess it's true. I think I heard Paul Tibbetts say this at one time. One of the young men was sitting at a bar and sitting next to a priest, and the priest started questioning him a little bit, and he thought, well, you can't go wrong telling everything to a priest. So he kind of opened up a little bit and talked a little more than he should and said that we were out there on a secret training mission to do something spectacular, that and Tibbetts had told us at this assembly that this should shorten the war by 2 years at least. Well, that was good news. And, you know, it's hard not to spread that around if you think you're going to bring this thing to a conclusion, because it was still a long, drawn-out war. And when he arrived back at the base, the priest was no longer in his priestly garb, but was in civilian clothes, and he was FBI.
Mm-hmm.
He was shipped out immediately. We never knew where he went. We never did hear. I didn't know the person. I assume it's true. You know, and you hear all these other stories about different ones that were tapped on the shoulder by somebody and saying, you're talking too much. The purpose of this furlough was not only to give us a little bit of rest before we went into the intense training, but also to test everybody. And so there were a lot of FBI agents all over the place. At railroad stations and bus stations, air depots, I guess.
So clearly you passed the test.
Evidently. I guess they just didn't hear when I was telling my folks all about it.
Did you tell your folks all about it?
I'm sure I did. I must have mentioned that it was really something great and they'd be hearing about us. But anyhow, we got back to the base and went into the intensive training. The first thing they did was cut our crew number down from 20 to 15, and also the number of our airplanes, and completely modified the 15 airplanes that were left, taking out all the gun turrets except the tail gun. So they stripped them of all the armament, and of course, nobody knew that, the why of that either, but it was to lighten the load, because these bombs were going to be about 10,000 pounds apiece. I'm sure we all questioned what in the world is going on here, because the crew started having to fly special missions with a lot of sandbags to load the airplane down. And also, they were disappearing for a week or two at a time to where we called Destination X. They were going to somewhere in Southern California, out on Inyo Desert, I think, for special bomb drop training. So it was just all kinds of things happening. And then during the training, about January of 45, Colonel Tibbetts decided he wanted his crews to do some practice bombing missions, flying over water to do overwater navigational missions. So he started sending about 4 or 5 crews at a time down to Havana, Cuba. Well, it's right near Havana, Cuba, at Batista Airfield.
Mm-hmm.
And we were at a little town called San Juan Batista. There again, we had security people right with us all the time. We were allowed to go on weekend leave into Havana, but we were always bumping into these guys in civilian clothes that we could see at the base, too. So, you know, you learn to keep your mouth shut.
Well, this had all started when they sent you to Nebraska. How'd you end up in this top secret unit to begin with?
They classified me as a truck driver. Well, I'd never driven a truck before in my life, and That, again, was the wisdom of the military, you know. There was a sergeant in the orderly room. Orderly rooms are the headquarters office for your squadron or your group or whatever. Looking through personnel records, noticed that I had been in the cadet training program and wondered what in the world I was doing driving a truck. And he called me into the office and asked me that very question. I said, well, that's what they classified me and sent me there to do. So
just following orders.
Following orders. So he said, you shouldn't be doing that. He said, with your training and experience, you probably ought to be in something else. He said, I do have an opening in the intelligence office as a clerk. Would you be interested? And I said, oh, yes, I would, definitely. So he sent me over to the intelligence office, where I became part of the 393rd Bomb Squadron Intelligence Office staff. That's where I remained for the full time I was in the service then. In a tactical unit, the intelligence office isn't the security necessarily, although they do have some security obligations. Their main objective and job is to brief the crews on target areas, also any aerial photographs that we have available, and then after they come back from their mission, an interrogation takes place. And you have to write up a report then for the interrogation, that the intelligence officers more or less judge how successful the mission was, because in the airplanes there were always cameras mounted in there that record the bomb from time it leaves the airplane till it hits the target area. Clicks every few seconds so that they can target it all the way down to hit the target area, hopefully hit the target area.
So that speaks to your role here. Again, a 19-year-old kid with all this responsibility, but none bigger than keeping that secret. And certainly in retrospect, we can understand why. Tell us about that sign you guys had in Wendover, Utah, because it sounds like that would kind of ingrain this concept in your mind.
It says, what you hear here, what you see here, when you leave here, let it stay here. And they meant it. I saw a full colonel be shipped to Alaska because his tongue got too loose over the bar, I guess. He was shipped out. He was the deputy group commander under Paul Tibbetts. I don't know what he said, but whatever he said got him shipped to Alaska, and that's where he stayed, I guess, for the rest of the war.
And that's a pretty strong deterrent to a young man like you.
Scared to death.
And you hadn't even left the States yet, but we're going to hear about that when we come back. Norris Jernigan will be headed to the National World War II Memorial with Central Valley Honor Flight and that special trip from the former Castle Air Force Base. But nearly 70 years ago, he got the report of the bombing of Hiroshima firsthand from the pilot of the Enola Gay. And he'll tell us what Paul Tibbetts said that day when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.